American politics may never be the same. On To The Point, we help you understand the trends driving this wild and woolly election.
Usually we don't have a presidential election in which the sanity of a major party candidate is really openly in question.
She's not the greatest politician. She says so herself.
She colors within the lines of American politics.
Does the Democratic Party need a reform? Absolutely.
I'm Armin Alney. Stay with To The Point through November and beyond on KCRW and KCRW.com.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Clinton and Trump had what we hope is their very last debate ever. It was probably the most substantive debate of the three, though Trump did find time to call Clinton a nasty woman and suggest he might not concede the election if he loses. And the Al Smith dinner, where the candidates are supposed to share some good-natured jokes about each other, wasn't very good-natured at all. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jameel Smith, senior national correspondent for MTV News. And our special guest is Kelly Goff, host of the WNYC show Political Party with Kelly Goff. Welcome, everybody. So I want to start with sound of a moment that wasn't Trump's most damaging moment of the last debate, but I think may have been the most emblematic moment of the debate for him.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody. Nobody has more respect.
Please, everybody.
And frankly, those stories have been largely debunked. And I really want to just talk about something slightly different.
Kelly, a lot of people think this campaign came about because Donald Trump was angry about the way Barack Obama made fun of him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2012, getting everyone to laugh at him. Is this
including
how it ends?
His wife, by the way.
Yes.
Who chuckled that night, yes.
Is this how it ends with Trump as the punchline he started as?
The interesting thing, though, is that he was a punchline throughout much of the primary, which is part of why he won, right? Because people kept underestimating him and treating him as a joke. I grew up in Tom DeLay's district in Texas, so I actually wasn't surprised to see his rise, I think, as much as some of my friends who are more kind of in the Beltway bubble were, because I know a lot of people who feel the way he does about a lot of issues, including Mexican immigrants, to be quite blunt. But I think to me, what was more emblematic about the clip you just played is not what he said, but the audience's reaction to it, you know, which is this is a man who just said to a local reporter, Colleen Marshall, I'm the least racist person you've ever met. And I thought to myself, did this woman grow up in like a Klan colony? Because if he's the least racist person she's ever met and he thinks that he's the least racist person, I think the biggest joke is that Donald Trump doesn't see how much of a joke he is and a lot of what comes out of his mouth is.
Rich, what did you make of this week's debate?
Well, it's always fascinating because he starts off, maybe with the exception of the second debate, but certainly the first debate in this one, he starts off very modulated. He speaks very softly, very slowly. This debate, he actually showed some substantive preparation. I was shocked when he referred to D.C. v. Heller, the famous gun case, as a well-crafted decision. I was like, wow, he's really studied up. And then you slowly see the wheels begin to wobble a little bit. His voice rises. You know, Hillary mentions the $14 million loan from his dad. And then he loses it.
Wrong.
And he starts interrupting again. He starts doing that whole Alec Baldwin act again. So he did pretty well on the issues. If you look at the CNN poll, post-debate poll, they were even on every single one of the issues. But there's so much personal and character baggage that he just can't defend. And then, of course, he blew himself up with the refusal to accept the legitimacy of the election, which drove at least 2 days worth of headlines.
It's funny, Rich, you mention him doing better in the beginning than the end, and it's clear that he had given some thought to the Supreme Court stuff. But I would note that Chris Wallace opened by asking this very broad question about how the Supreme Court should work and how it should think about the Constitution. And before Trump got around to calling Heller a well-crafted decision, the first thing he said about the court was that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had said some very inappropriate things about him and that she had had to apologize for that. And I actually, you know, I don't think Ruth Bader Ginsburg should be commenting on politics broadly or on Donald Trump, but that the first thing it occurred to him to mention about the court is that members of the court should be nice to him. I actually thought was very emblematic of the way Donald Trump thinks about politics. Jameel, what did you think?
Well, I saw first the first discussion of abortion, which I thought was very interesting. You saw Clinton give a really forceful feminist defense of abortion rights and access, two separate issues. And then you saw Trump completely misstate facts about part, you know, so-called partial birth abortion, talking about ripping babies out of the womb. I think his inability to speak in anything but hyperbole hurts him when he's trying to be taken seriously on an issue, even if it's an issue on which a lot of his base agrees on. So you see an issue like abortion, which animates a lot of Republican voters, and he talks in complete fantasies and conspiracy theories as opposed to addressing, say, a real religious concerns with abortion. And I think that hurts him in the long run.
You know, that's actually interesting because I thought that Chris Wallace actually did a fabulous job as debate moderator. I think that he forced them both to actually defend their records and to give substantive responses. And he played referee. And it was interesting because remember, he said, I don't think my job is to fact check. That's not my job. That's their job before the debate. But I thought he did a really good job of diplomatically, you know, fact checking them in a subtle way. Except the one quibble I did have, though, was him using the term partial birth abortion repeatedly, which is not a real medical term, and it is a term of propaganda. But in the same way that, you know, I've said this before about the term marriage equality, no one called interracial marriage marriage equality. They called it interracial marriage. Same-sex marriage became marriage equality because that helped it gain traction with voters. And I think that when you're moderating a debate, it's actually the responsibility of the journalist doing so to be as impartial as possible. And that, to me, was a little bit of a tell.
Also, it's funny because I thought Chris Wallace had a mixed performance. I didn't like, there were some questions that I would have definitely phrased differently. But the thing is, I think people overrate in evaluating the moderator what the moderator says. The important thing is what the moderator elicits out of the candidates. And I think we really did learn a lot about the candidates on policy, more so than we did in the other two debates. I really have to give Chris Wallace credit for that. Rich, I was interested to know what you thought about that abortion answer, because one thing that sort of amazed me about it is that the Donald Trump used this language about ripping fetuses out of the womb that was sort of grossly vivid. But people have tended to think of Trump as a person who never cared about abortion, who had a totally cynical flop on it to try to get the Republican nomination. And it almost seemed to me like he was talking about it like a person who actually cared about abortion as a moral issue, which seemed unusual for him.
Yeah, his flip on this issue, we can assume, was entirely opportunistic. But I think, you know, he sounded quite passionate on it. And Hillary Clinton was typically mendacious about it, making it sound as though these abortions are always for medical reasons, which is not the case. Sure, a partial birth abortion is not a medical term, but so what? We don't refer to a lot of things by their technical medical terms. And the
I just think more journalists
the point that Trump the point that Trump was getting at is correct, that Hillary Clinton doesn't really support any restriction on any abortion at any time whatsoever, and she's the true radical on this issue.
But Rich, that's not entirely fair, because I've written about this issue a lot, and particularly about the limitations that come later when and the majority of the cases, and the, you know, I say this as someone who's a religious person from a religious background, most Americans agree with you and with Hillary Clinton and with Wendy Davis, who had two late term abortions, that they should be extremely rare and if not to preserve the life of the mother, to preserve the quality of life of the potential fetus. And so while you'd be correct that statistically it's not always to save the life of the mother, it is often because the life of the fetus in late stage abortions, late term abortions, which is the appropriate, accurate term, not partial birth abortions, is because of the quality of life of a fetus that might not survive, which was the case of Wendy Davis, the Texas gubernatorial candidate. So what I thought was fascinating is that here we have the first likely female president, the only person on that stage who'd actually carried a child at any point and given birth, was having to explain to a man why it is that a woman would possibly even contemplate such a choice, even when she actually wanted a child. And so to me, that was actually the real takeaway from this conversation. And yet Hillary Clinton never mentioned being a mother, never mentioned having been in that position, which again goes to the kind of caught in the middle if you're a minority running for office, where I think every woman watching that thought about the fact that she was the only one there who'd carried a child, but she didn't even mention, you know, I'm the only one who's been on this stage and been in that position. So to me, it was a powerful and fascinating takeaway. And I thought it was the most substantive conversation we've seen on the issue.
I want to turn to another moment from the debate that was a laugh line, but also had some serious policy substance behind it. This is Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton trading accusations about who's under the control of Vladimir Putin.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of
no
the United
puppet.
States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty clear you won't admit
no,
that the
puppet.
Russians have engaged.
So, Jamil, I wonder, looking at this as someone coming from the left, are you concerned at all that we're setting up for a Clinton administration that's going to be reflexively hostile to Russia because Hillary Clinton will be understandably angry about Vladimir Putin's efforts to sway this election?
No, actually, I don't. What I'm more worried about is whether or not people are going to be a little bit less informed about what's actually happening with Russia and what actually Putin has done, because the conversation is centered so much on Trump and so much on their efforts to influence our elections that we don't actually talk about what Russia does. And frankly, I think it's going to be, you know, up to us in the press to educate people about what issues does Russia actually, you know, what issues is Russia involved in that will affect our daily lives? And something that is, you know, is mendacious as this, you know, this all this stuff about Trump, you know, saying that, oh, well, you don't know if they actually hacked into our emails. No, come on, man. Like, I just want to have a conversation that actually deals with the reality of what is happening in Russia and not necessarily all the time having to focus on whether or not someone's a puppet or someone is, you know, endorsing espionage.
No, you're the puppet. I think.
Oh, you're the puppet, Josh. I just really, you know, there are a lot of really interesting and important issues, gay rights, journalistic freedom, to name a couple, that Russia is an important factor in. And I think that if we're going to talk about the, you know, foreign policy, the real stuff that's actually happening, we should get to that and not really, you know, be focusing on all this puppet stuff. It will be a relief when we can do that.
Rich, there was a question about Syria that was fundamentally about Russia, and Hillary Clinton was asked, basically, if we were to have a no-fly zone like she's previously advocated, would that mean that we'd be in a position of having to shoot down Russian aircraft that conducted operations over Syria? And her answer, I thought, was this sort of word salad, basically, about, you know, we wouldn't just go in and put in a no-fly zone. It would be the product of negotiations. But again, I have trouble seeing why in negotiations with the Russians we'd get an agreement out of them that would allow us to have an effective no-fly zone. So is there, in that area of substantive international relations with Russia, are you seeing anything from either candidate that looks like it would address that situation?
No, and it's because it's such a difficult situation, but I don't see how a no-fly zone is remotely plausible in current circumstances, given it might involve shooting down Russian planes. One. Two, even if Russia wasn't part of the equation, we've learned past experience with no-fly zones. Once you establish one, you really own the entire conflict and what's happening on the ground. So it's always everyone's default, because it's relatively easy to say, oh, let's just do something from the air and it's very unlikely we'll lose any of our people. But it's always the first step in a much more substantial intervention.
We're going to take a quick break. Let us know what you thought about Wednesday's debate at kcrw.com/LRC. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC. Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jamil Smith of MTV News. And Kelly Goff, host of WNYC's Political Party with Kelly Goff, is also with us. So I'm going to turn in a second to November 9th. But first, I wanted to play a little bit of sound from the Al Smith Dinner. That's the charity dinner in New York for Catholic Charities that happened this week. Supposed to be where the two candidates come together on the same stage for the last time before the election and share some good-natured ribbing of each other. It went a little bit off the rails.
People look at the Statue of Liberty and they see a proud symbol of our history as a nation of immigrants, a beacon of hope for people around the world. Donald looks at the Statue of Liberty and sees a 4. Maybe a 5 if she loses the torch and tablet and changes her hair.
For example, here she is tonight in public, pretending not to hate Catholics.
So normally there isn't booing at the Al Smith dinner, but Donald Trump was rather lustily booed. And this has me wondering, you know, on November 9th, we're going to have to pick up the pieces and try to govern this country. And I want to talk about two scenarios. One, I think the most likely scenario is that Hillary Clinton wins the election and Republicans continue to control at least one House of Congress. And they're going to have to find a way to work together. The other scenario is that things collapse so badly for Republicans that Hillary has the whole thing. But let's start by thinking about a divided government. Rich, are there lessons for House Republicans to take away from this about their own strategy over the last few years? Should they be basically doing to a President Clinton what they did with President Obama and trying to stand in the way of everything? And what does that look like government-wise?
Well, I tend to think assuming Hillary wins but gets less than 50, which is a realistic scenario, this is going to be a bitter fight from the very beginning. The email scandal will live on into the Clinton administration. The Clinton Foundation will live on into the Clinton administration. So there'll be multiple investigations going on. There'll be very little appetite for cooperating on anything important. And she'll have to govern the way President Obama has the last 2 years through executive order and unilateral action, much of it very constitutionally dubious. So anyone who's looking for a new dawn in January, when and if Hillary Clinton is inaugurated president, is, I believe, going to be sorely disappointed.
Well, after that glass half full rosy picture that Rich just painted, allow me to come in and be a bit of an optimistic contrarian. I actually am feeling much more optimistic than I was. And part of why I'm a bit more optimistic is, I mean, I know that you know this, Josh, I consider myself a bit of a recovering Democrat and I'm an independent now. And one of the reasons is because, you know, I've met a lot of really great Republicans and living in the Northeast, you know, the people, that's my friends from the South tell me, you know, they grow the Republicans very differently in the Northeast than they do in the South, right? So I grew up in Tondelier's district. But the reason I'm a bit more optimistic is because my family is overwhelmingly Democratic, you know, African-American Democrats who grew up in the segregated South. And the conversations I've been having a lot with them have actually been not just about how terrible Trump has been, but about how great so many Republicans have been in denouncing them, especially, you know, coming from Texas. Something that's come up a lot in my family is how as the Bushes and the grace that they've shown in, you know, multiple members of the family, Billy Bush notwithstanding, in terms of his role in this election, but Mitt Romney and people like that, and how they've not just denounced Trump, but specifically called him racist or language that he's used racist. I think it's helping to kind of reset the table that good people and bad people are not label specific or party specific. They come in all shapes and sizes. And so I'm hoping that after this really horrible election, we're going to be able to be in a place where we can restart the conversation of good people in politics versus bad people in politics, not just Democrats versus Republicans. And I'm really excited for that.
Jamil, do you share that hope at all?
Well, actually, perhaps the best word to use is pragmatic. I'm looking at the pressure she's going to face from the left. And in light of the scenario that Rich paints, which I do think is realistic, I don't understand exactly how she's going to accomplish, especially a lot of the social justice goals that she set forth, say, in a first term, if, in fact, Republicans maintain control of the House and the Senate. So today, for instance, she's meeting with Campaign Zero leaders DeRay McKesson and Brittany Pecknett. These are people who are, you know, part of the Black Lives Matter movement, who are, you know, trying to engineer serious and substantive police reforms. And I'm not sure what she's going to be able to tell them to, you know, do anything more than to maybe win their vote. I mean, in this context, it shouldn't be that difficult. But going forward, I really want to see how groups like that not only pressure Hillary Clinton, but also what kind of results they end up.
But they also have to be pragmatic, too, which I don't think all groups on both sides who have specific goals that speak to their base are always as pragmatic as the politicians who care about those goals are. But I actually think that that's an issue that kind of reinforces what I'm talking about. One of the things that's not gotten that much coverage this election cycle is if you look at which Republicans have actually been more vocal on those issues, such as pushing for body cameras, such as saying that we need to have a better relationships with law enforcement. You know, John McCain now has an African-American daughter-in-law. John Boehner now has an African-American son-in-law. Mitt Romney now has an African-American grandson. When you have skin in the game, literally, in terms of your own family, it helps reset the table about what your own priorities are when it comes to issues that you may not have cared about, like social justice. It's not a coincidence that those men, as well as Tim Scott, the lone African-American Republican senator, have been among the people talking about the importance of body cameras and actually trying to do something. So my point is that I think that, you know, on the surface, you all are absolutely right. I do not expect a magic wand to be waved and for Washington to all of a sudden start singing Kumbaya. What I do expect, though, is that there is going to be more of a desire for people to become more civil in a way we haven't seen. On my show, Josh, I just have to say, my first episode, you know, we were interviewing members of Congress who said that there are times that if they want to have dinner with someone on the other side of the aisle, they do it in secret at their homes so that the leadership doesn't find out, which is absurd. And so I'm thinking that post Donald Trump, at some point people are going to go, that's actually so ridiculous. We should be able to have a conversation or play golf together and not treat it as if, you know, that's violating some sort of code.
Another factor here is Paul Ryan is assuming, I think the most likely scenario is Republicans lose the Senate and hold the House. So he'll be, you know, the one national leader left standing. And he's going to be under incredible pressure because the Trump right hates him now with a passion. They never liked him. Now they really hate him. They want to devote every ounce of energy they can to destroying him. So that's going to make it even harder for him to compromise with Hillary Clinton on anything. And a major fissure on the right is going to be the debate over so-called comprehensive immigration reform. Because if Trump, you know, gets 15 to 20% of the Latino vote and loses states like Arizona, the establishment is going to be very eager to do this again. And Trump voters and people like myself are going to want to oppose it with every fiber of our being. So part of the ugliness in Washington will be an inter-Republican fight.
And Hillary's more of a schmoozer, though, than President Obama enjoys doing.
That's true.
So that's an important factor. She actually likes socializing with people in general, and that's something he's not as into.
Rich, I was hoping you could help me game out a scenario we discussed a little last week, which is suppose that Paul Ryan comes back with a very slim majority, 3 or 4 or 5 seats, and he's more beholden than ever to members of the Freedom Caucus who have been resistant to him, who have withheld their votes in past elections for the speakership. Does that make him more resistant to Democrats, or can it actually put him in a position where he's dependent on support for Democrats in order to be able to make the House work? Is it possible at all that that actually pushes him toward deal making because he just doesn't have the numbers to do a full on resistance strategy?
Yeah. Well, we saw this with John Boehner, that on must pass legislation, it ended up being further to the left than it would have had to been otherwise because there wasn't a united Republican caucus. So it could push Paul Ryan leftward, centerward in that sense. But if he's doing that again, it means he's as miserable as John Boehner is and as on a short leash in a way as John Boehner is and kind of looking over a shoulder every single day to see who may be trying to shiv him. And this will be a tragedy in all sorts of ways, but among others, personally for Paul Ryan, because he didn't really want the job, and he took it on the condition that this sort of dynamic wouldn't hold, and it might be right back here with a vengeance.
Jamil, let's talk a little about the wish scenario for you, or what I assume is, where Democrats sweep their way through the whole thing. What are you looking to Hillary Clinton to make a first priority in that situation?
I'd look for her to make immigration certainly one of those top priorities. It's certainly one of the top priorities of students whom we speak to on these campuses where they're holding these debates. But moreover, I want her to start talking about something that they never spoke about in the debates, and that's climate change. I want to see her take, you know, action beyond the Paris Accords and also do things that, you know, deal specifically with environmental justice in ways climate change has produced disparate impacts along racial lines, along gender lines, along economic lines.
And Rich, what do Republicans do if they get wiped out?
Oh, well, I mean, it'll be very bitter. It'll be even bitter than it would be ordinarily because there's just no locus of power and there's really nothing to do for 2 years except for shoot at each other. And a lot of Trump supporters now, you can just see them, including campaign manager Kellyanne Conway, more than making the case for Trump, they're preparing the ground for the post-election debate about what went wrong with Trump. And they're going to argue that he was stabbed in the back. People like me are going to argue, no, this was a hideous mistake to nominate him in the first place. And if there's no power in Washington, that we'll spend all our time.
Can I actually ask about the column you wrote this week, which was basically, you know, don't blame Never Trump for the loss of Trump, that, you know, voters made their own decision here and they're rejecting him because he's a terrible candidate. They don't really listen to us intellectuals. And I guess my question is the thesis of your column not that you have no influence at all? If conservative intellectuals for a year talking constantly about how unacceptable Donald Trump is had no role in the electorate's rejection of Donald Trump, then what are conservative intellectuals for?
Well, it's certainly important in setting a general climate. But the idea that, you know, suburban women in Philadelphia are sitting and reading Charles Krauthammer's latest column, or the blogger Ace of Spades, who hates all the Never Trumpers, and deciding what she's going to do, I think is completely ridiculous. So intellectually, it's very important. It's important for setting a climate. But the idea that it accounts for Trump's electoral weaknesses, I think, is just ridiculous, because he consolidated most of the party. And what he's done is, you know, he's had the biggest megaphone on the planet. You know, he's stood three times in these debates in front of audiences of 60, 70, 80 million people. And that's just the single most important factor in the election, how he actually performs. And he's performed in a way to repel these voters. So the defeat, if it comes, is going to be overwhelmingly on him and no one else.
And Billy Bush. And Howard Stern. The people he actually talks to about, you know, stuff.
Kelly, I'll give you the last word before we go to rants. What are your hopes for post-election in this Democratic sweep scenario?
Oh, well, if she were to have more of a mandate, I think that we would see her talk about reproductive justice more. I think that sort of like President Obama was sort of caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of how he talked about race. I think Hillary Clinton during this campaign has felt a bit that way about how she talks about gender issues.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jamil Smith, what's your rant?
Well, I think that there is still a way that Republicans can distance themselves from Trump in a really effective and constructive way, and that is to do their jobs in the Senate, and that's take up the nomination of Merrick Garland. I think what they can do there by taking up that nomination, by doing, you know, staging an up or down vote, by staging hearings, is show that there are Republicans who are elected, who are actually taking government seriously, but also upholding conservative values. You can oppose Merrick Garland all you want, but give him a hearing in front of the American people.
Rich Lowry.
One critique of American higher education is that academics spend too much time on pointless research. Exhibit A could be a very seasonal paper by two academics on, quote, the perilous whiteness of pumpkins, which purports to uncover how pumpkin spice lattes are a hateful totem of white privilege, although the paper does concede that pumpkins, quote, are real material food plants in addition to being cultural symbols. Thanks, guys. Now, please go do something more useful, like teach some students.
Kelly Goff.
Please tell me that paper was The Onion. My rant is, I want to, even though the most memorable moment of the debate for a lot of people was Donald Trump essentially saying he might not concede, I think to most women it was when he called her such a nasty woman. And I've seen people reclaiming that and embracing that title. I'm so excited that Janet Jackson's hit with that in the title has made a comeback thanks to the debate. But the one thing I do have to complain about is that so many people who are not even politically engaged have been making money off of selling crap this election cycle using either Donald Trump's quotes or lines like nasty woman. The New York Times just did a big piece about people who have been capitalizing and exploiting these lines. And so Kelly Goff, the nasty woman, says, please stop.
For my rant, there's going to be a lot of soul searching that needs to be done after this election, probably more than actually will get done. But one thing I hope people will think about is Donald Trump's con that he's been running for the last 16 months is just a variation on the con that he's been running for 40 years, selling an image that does not reflect what he does. He doesn't even really develop that much real estate anymore. He slaps his name on other people's buildings. And so a country that so much of which was able to fall for his political con has also been falling for his business cons, and I hope people will think a little bit about, if so many people fell for this, what am I falling for that has no actual substance behind it, even outside the political realm? That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Jamil Smith, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.